What I want to do tonight is take you on a very rapid trip to the moon, fill in a few of the some information about how all of that happened and why, and maybe a little bit about what we learned. The picture you see on the screen right now, however, is a picture of the planet Mars taken by the Hubble Space Telescope at a particularly clear time in Mars, in the evolution of the Mars climate. The reason I show that is both to acknowledge the role that the Mars Society of Australia has had in my visit to Australia on this occasion, but also to indicate where I think the next great adventure for young people will lie. The exploration and ultimate settlement of Mars is just one of those things that will probably happen within the lifetimes of young people alive today on Earth. Indeed, the parents of the first Martians are very probably walking around somewhere on this planet. Now, that might startle you a little bit, and to startle you maybe even a little bit more, just imagine that you may become the grandparents of the first Martians. That might interest you to some degree. Now, but to go to the moon, we needed a great deal of equipment. It's hard to say if there was any specific technology, maybe a few materials and certain types of electronics that were developed specifically for Apollo that did not exist before that time. Apollo primarily took advantage of the technological base, the base of know-how that existed before the challenge was issued by President John Kennedy for our generation to go to the moon and return safely to Earth. That challenge issued in May of 1961. Now, that technology that we used is incorporated in the Saturn V launch vehicle. That's the rocket you see on the left of this picture. It is the largest rocket ever used to take human beings in space, made up of three stages. It weighed I'm going to gauge the age of the audience here. I think most of you know the English system of measure. It weighed about 6.8 million pounds. The thrust of the five engines in the first stage rocket was 7.5 million pounds, which meant we could very gradually get off the Earth with the initial stage of this rocket. The spacecraft and other necessary equipment was housed on top of this rocket. And here you see a view of the top looking back towards the vehicle assembly building way off there in the distance. You saw that on the right of the spacecraft. I'm going to go back to that just in a moment. But the spacecraft that we had, the command and service module, is that part of that is the cone-shaped object underneath the small rocket on top. And inside, the next part of the rocket covered there is the lunar module Challenger. Now, the vehicle assembly building there on the right, at the time it was constructed, was the largest enclosed space on Earth. It has, and to give you an idea of just how big it is, even today, there is a fire engine, a large fire engine, in the lower right-hand portion of this picture, which may have escaped your attention. It is, and that also gives you an idea of just how big the Saturn V rocket is. The unfortunately or fortunately, depending on your perspective, the largest enclosed space I believe in the world today is a shopping mall in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The training that we did for Apollo was a wide mixture of different types of training, obviously dominated by learning how to fly spacecraft that we would only fly once. And to do that, we used the simulators that were computer-driven, driven by huge banks of computers that fill floors of buildings. And now, though, most of you probably have on your desk, either in your office or at home, a PC or a Mac of some kind that has the equivalent power, probably more, than we had in those computers in those days, some 30 and 40 years ago. The simulators were extremely well taken, however. We never felt that we lacked for a good representation of how the spacecrafts would function in space. We did not do any significant dynamic simulation. That, after a few launches, we felt was clearly something you could adapt to very quickly. Also, though, by the time our mission was training, and indeed for the Apollo 13 mission, we had a new method of training pilots to be very, very competent field geologists on the moon, not with the experience that I would bring to the table or another field geologist might have. But still, we were able, with 3 or 4 days a month of this kind of training over a 15-month training cycle, we were able to bring them well along. And as a result, we have a collection of samples from the moon that really are quite remarkable and have given us the basis for a clear understanding of the evolution of the moon and a very nice debate going on its origin. Here, this picture is taken in the Flagstaff, Arizona area. It is in the volcanic field of that part of the United States, and we are using essentially all of the equipment or versions thereof that we would have on the moon, including a working model of the roving vehicle. Now, why my compatriot on the mission, Captain Eugene Cernan, felt he had to wear a Green Bay Packers hat and a checkered pants on a trip like this, I don't know. It clearly is not standard uniform for geologists. He is a Navy test pilot and also a very talkative one. And here you see that he has put his lunar module pilot to sleep, discussing some particular aspect of our examination of the actual flight roving vehicle that you see there in the foreground of this picture. That roving vehicle was folded up in a remarkable exercise of mechanical engineering, stuffed into the lunar module, which you see there in the background. United States sign is on one side of it. And we later deployed it, as you will see, on the lunar surface. We also undertook we undertook a modest amount of what generally came under the heading of survival training. Early in our training period, we spent some time in the jungles, we spent some time out in the ocean, and also in the deserts of the Earth, just in case, on return to Earth, we didn't quite hit where the carrier expected us to hit, and we had to spend a few days waiting for somebody to find us. This shows some very young and skeptical-looking astronauts in the jungles of Panama learning about the care and feeding of boa constrictor, ultimately to be eaten. But on December 7th, 1972, Florida time, 30 years ago this year, we left the Earth for the moon for the last of the Apollo series of lunar landings. At this point in our liftoff, the main physical sensation was one of extreme vibration. The five big engines of the first stage rocket interact in such a way to give you a very, very heavy, very low heavy low-frequency vibration of the rocket. Those of you who have seen the movie Apollo 13 will recall that at that point, there were big sheets of ice coming off the side of the rocket, ice that had condensed on the side of the cold fuel tanks out of the Florida atmosphere. If you want a rough analogy of what it might feel like to be in a rocket at this point, you might take your car, or your four-wheel drive vehicle, and drive down a railroad track with your tires on the sleepers rather than on the rails, and drive it quite fast, because that's pretty much the kind of vibration that we experienced. Once we were in orbit at about 90 miles orbital altitude and 18,000 miles an hour, we had a little time to look out the window and take a few pictures, but that was not our primary purpose for two orbits of the Earth. That purpose was to make sure that all of the rocket and spacecraft systems we would need to go to the moon and to land there were indeed in working order. Here, though, you see a picture I took of the western desert edge of the Kalahari in Africa. And then a little while later, we were over this would be the western South Pacific, and had this beautiful cloud bank to look at. And I show this picture in large part just to have you look in the upper left-hand portion of the picture and see that narrow band of blue, which is our atmosphere. And I'll be drawing your attention to that a little bit later. But that atmosphere, as you well know, is very important to us being able to sit here in this room and hear about what we're talking about tonight. Once we had made sure that everything was in working order, we accelerated to 25,000 miles an hour using, once again, the third stage of the Saturn V rocket. We shut that down, and at that moment, some more ice came off, and that's what you see around this rocket at this time. Those little bright pieces, bright objects around the end of the rocket are indeed pieces of ice that we've carried with us from Florida. The lunar module Challenger that we were going to take to the moon is stuck away in the end of the rocket, and at this point, Ron Evans, the third man on our crew, was preparing to dock with it in order to extract it and take it with us onto the moon. That flight to the moon took 3.5 days, and on about the second day, on the first day, soon after we had the lunar module in tow, I had a chance to take this picture from about 34,000 miles away. This picture of a nearly full Earth, the Mediterranean at the top, Antarctica and the South Pole at the bottom, is still the most requested picture from the NASA archives and probably will remain that way. And the crew, I think, is very proud of having supplied that to so many uses here on Earth. I think the worst use I ever saw was its printing in an old TWA flight magazine where you will appreciate this, where they weren't satisfied with how this looked, and so they moved Australia into the Indian Ocean. Speaking of Australia, after about a day and a half headed towards the moon, we had this view of the South Pacific and your continent in full view, although slightly obscured by clouds, unusual for December, as I understand it, but still a very nice view, and indeed the dominant beacon in the South Pacific, not only on this particular day, but on all the days that we had on the moon when the South Pacific was in view. With the naked eye, you could see Australia quite clearly, even from the moon. If you look carefully, just above your continent, know your geography of the South Pacific, you can see some small aggregation of spots that represent the Philippines and Philippine Islands. Each one has a thunderhead on it at this time of day. And just to the left in the Philippine Sea is a very, very dense white batch of clouds, and that turns out to be a typhoon that had formed in the Philippine Sea or near it and had stalled there, not moving for our whole flight. It had been given the name, coincidentally, Teresa, as typhoons sometimes are, and it was maybe a precursor to my marriage to Teresa Fitzgibbon some many years later after my Senate career. 3.5 days, we had what is called the loss of signal point, or LOS, where for the next 45 minutes in this first orbit, as well as all other orbits of the moon, we had no communications with the Earth. The moon obviously was in the way, blocked the radio signals, S-band transmissions that we used, and as long as nothing was going wrong, that was a very nice thing to have. You didn't have the so-called Houston Mission Control Center trying to tell you to do this or that during that 45 minutes, and nor were such instructions planned for that period of time. Several of the missions, however, did have problems in lunar orbit that had to be worked out, and they all were, but it would have been very nice if the moon had just moved out of the way and let us communicate continuously. Sunrise on the far side of the moon for the spacecraft, actually a sunset on the moon you see here, and it gives you a good illustration of what the surface of the moon looked like, particularly near what is called a terminator, where it is a beauty of contrast rather than one of color. And the reason for that, of course, is demonstrated by looking at the horizon of the moon. That horizon has no band of blue around it. There is no atmosphere on the moon. In fact, at the surface of the moon, you fundamentally have a deep space vacuum. The moon's gravitational field is about 1/6 the strength of that of the Earth, and that and 1/6 gravity just isn't enough to hold any sensible atmosphere to the lunar surface. And that means there's no oxygen to oxidize the iron minerals, which is the principal reason why our deserts are nice yellow and orange and red colors, unlike what we see on the moon. Mars, of course, is quite oxidized and will represent a much more familiar environment, particularly those Australian astronauts that are lucky enough to go to Mars someday. The Valley of Taurus-Littrow was the target of our interest on Apollo 17. It is a deep mountain valley cutting across a ridge of mountains that surround a very large basin on the moon known as the Serenitatis Basin. That basin is partially filled by lavas, as is the valley itself, a type of lava called basalt. And those of you who have any interest in rocks know about basalt. In the Melbourne area, you have a significant amount of that. I believe it's called bluestone and has contributed to the construction of many buildings. And we'll see some of the close-ups of the basalts on the moon here in a moment. We were going to land between two craters right in the center of the valley, just this side of that plume-like white feature, and I think you can probably pick that out. The other spacecraft is right in the center of this photograph. If you take a good hard look at it, particularly those of you up front, you can see the Command and Service Module America with Ron Evans on board, and doing, at this point, taking some very, very important navigational sightings that when they were processed in Houston and fed back into our computer and guidance system, it enabled us to land within a few tens of meters of exactly where we wanted to land before we left the Earth. Deep space navigation, particularly navigation in the vicinity of the moon, turned out to be a major forte of the Apollo program. Let me just say a little bit more about the valley. It's about 50 kilometers long, about 7.5 kilometers wide, and the mountains on either side, particularly those on the left side of the valley in this picture, rise to heights of about 2,100 meters. So it's a spectacular place, deeper than the Grand Canyon of our Colorado in the southwestern United States. First view I had after landing is this one out the right-hand window of the lunar module. We have, of course, not had any excursions or activities on the surface, so the surface is relatively undisturbed, and you can see really pretty much what it would look like if you had had a chance to be there. Scattered small to large craters, scattered blocks of this basalt that I mentioned, this basalt being very different than what you have here and elsewhere on Earth in that there is absolutely no water in it, which is characteristic of most Earth basalts, and also they happen to be very, very rich in the element titanium. The object in the foreground, some 3 to 5 kilometers away from the base of the mountains there, is the metallic object, is the one of 16 small rockets that we use to control the attitude or orientation of our spacecraft during powered flight. Those small rockets, only had about 50-pound thrust in contrast to the 1.5 million pounds of thrust of the first-stage engines of the Saturn V. So you can see we span a great spectrum of technology relative to propulsion as well as to most other areas of technology available to us at that time. The Challenger is seen here from about 75 meters away. It was really a very, very comfortable camp. It's about 11 meters high. Sitting there, you can see the two stages, the descent and ascent stages of Challenger. The descent stage contained essentially everything we were going to use, operate, or consume while we were on the lunar surface, including that lunar roving vehicle that I mentioned earlier. The ascent stage was basically our bedroom, kitchen, bathroom, all rolled up into one. Quite crowded when we got out of the spacesuits. As you'll see in a moment, those spacesuits obviously are larger than we are, and although we got out of them in order to be much more comfortable than normal than we would have otherwise, still it made the small spacecraft quite crowded. The food was good. The food was freeze-dried, our dehydrated food that we reconstituted with water from the spacecraft tanks. We also had hammocks in which to sleep, and sleeping in 1/6 gravity is really quite nice. No tossing and turning to speak of at all. And then maybe most importantly to me as a geologist, and maybe to some of you who have spent time in the bush, there's no black flies to bother. This picture will give you a little bit more feeling, I think, for the desert-like quality of the moon, absent the color. Looking across a boulder field at the edge of a 600-meter diameter crater that we call Camelot, and with the lunar rover fully deployed there in the middle ground. The main thing you have to remember about the ambiance of the moon is that even though you have a sun as bright as any Australian sun you may have ever seen, it is in a black sky, an absolute black sky. And that's what you have to get used to, and frankly, I don't think I ever did quite get used to it, because it creates such a contrast, not only with the mountains that you see here, but also with the Earth itself. There you see the Earth, still not as black a sky, not nearly as black a sky as we experienced, but still not too far away, only 400,000 kilometers. Home is where you see it in this case. And with the communications that we had, it really, I personally never felt the least bit homesick, just very thankful to be there and have these experiences. The lunar roving vehicle now is a little bit closer view. Gene Cernan and I have just deployed this. It really was a mechanical miracle in how it deployed. All we had to do finally was to put a couple pins in the frame in order to make sure that it didn't collapse on us, which it didn't, and drive it away. The wheels had, each wheel had an independent motor drive, independent suspension, front and rear wheel steering, significant stability even at the 10 to 12 kilometers velocity that we could drive it over these particular surfaces. It was electrical powered, and you may be thinking, well, 10 kilometers an hour isn't much. I mean, that doesn't seem like very fast. Well, when you're in 1/6 gravity, every time you hit a bump at that speed, or most speeds, you're going to be off the ground. And if you hit the bump with a little bit of rotation, if you're going too fast, you're going to end up on your side. Now, that wouldn't have been catastrophic. We would have gotten dirty, as we did anyway, probably just undid our seat belts and got up, turned the rover back on its wheels, and drove away. Really very, 1/6 gravity is very forgiving in that respect. We, getting on the lunar rover was reasonably straightforward. You stand at the side, jump up into the vacuum, a little bit of leftward translation, and hope that you come down in the seat assigned to you. The television camera that showed most of the pictures that some of you may have seen is seen there on the post in the foreground, electronics in that area where otherwise it would have been a bumper, with some radiating surfaces to keep them cool. The batteries are underneath those white covers, and some equipment on the back. Gene Cernan, of course, is not in the picture, as he had to take this picture of me getting on the lunar rover. One of the about the only problem that really seriously impacted the schedule of our mission was a repeat of what had happened on other flights with the lunar rover, two other flights, and that the commander succeeded in breaking the fender off. And you may think that's a minor occurrence, but on the moon, those fenders really were dust flaps, and for the very simple reason that when you drove this, small particles of the dust and fragments of rock on the lunar surface would actually travel up the wheel long enough and far enough to give you a forward rooster tail so that you would end up driving into your own dust. And that was not something that worked out very well for us. We tried it for a little while and decided we better get a fix. And the fix that was suggested by our friends in the Mission Control Center was to tape together some unneeded photo maps using, you probably already guessed it, some gray duct tape that I see here on the floor, except it's black, and it's probably elsewhere holding this building together as it it held our fender together on the moon. Needless to say, We became honorary members of every automotive repair organization in the United States, and maybe elsewhere, as I recall. The spacesuit that I mentioned, you see here, the spacesuit, the backpack, my own weight totaled about 370 pounds. But on the moon, that's Earth pounds, on the moon, it would total, of course, only about 61 pounds. And if you're wondering why astronauts that you may have heard on in videos and CDs and the like seem to be having a great time on the moon, it's because it's a lot of fun, certainly a lot of fun compared to training, and just a lot of fun specifically. This was taken on the first of our three excursions. We were actually outside the spacecraft 22 hours total, about 7.5 hours or so per excursion. And I haven't quite gotten really dirty here. You can just see the dust has crept up to about my knees. By the end of the second excursion, it was everywhere. I had succeeded in falling down enough times that obviously doing very aggressive geology and that kind of thing, but still falling down. And again, you have to, falling down in 1/6 gravity does not particularly concern anyone because you don't hit very hard. And you can get up very easily as well. The only real discomfort we had with this suit was in the gloves. They're really balloons shaped like your hand, and so and with a pressure inside the suit of 3.7 pounds per square inch, anytime you wanted to pick something up, you had to squeeze against that pressure. And that's like squeezing a tennis ball continuously. And if you do it too fast at first, as we all did, trying to do everything all at once, your forearms get tremendously fatigued, and you just have to back off and realize you can only squeeze it every once in a while. So you learn all sorts of tricks about how to avoid that fatigue and discomfort from it. One of them is, you just see, this particular tool, I just rested against my hand rather than gripping it. The interesting thing about all of that to me is, from a biomedical point of view, is that after a rest period on the moon of some 8 hours or so, when you get up and start to suit up again for your next excursion, there's no residual soreness in those muscles at all. So the cardiovascular system is much more efficient in reduced gravity, and the toxins that otherwise would damage the muscles during heavy use are removed before they can do that. And all you do is fatigue the muscle rather than damage it. Large boulders have rolled down the sides of the steep slopes of this valley, which worked out very nicely for us since we weren't going to try to climb up to outcrops or the sources of these boulders. And indeed, here you see a very, very large boulder, the largest that we identified on our pre-mission photographs. Yours truly on the left for scale. And that boulder had rolled down the mountain based on a sample we took. You see that scrape in the dirt on the front face of the boulder there. That was a sample taken of that material, and we could actually tell how long that material had been exposed to the radiation of space and determine when this boulder actually rolled to its present position. That turned out to be about 800,000 years ago, and in lunar terms, not very long. And it had left a track about 1.5 kilometers long that we could trace right back up to where it came from on the mountain. Now, if you look carefully, you'll see my footprints going down into that track, out of sight briefly, and up the other side. Those footprints will stay in recognizable form for about 1 million years, maybe 2 million years. Just depends on exactly how intense is the, we might call it the rain of micrometeorites that are hitting the moon continuously. And we don't have a real good feeling for what that frequency is yet. It's, for strangely enough, been fairly hard to measure. But we do know that from other data that over about 1 million or 2 million years, about 1 centimeter or 2 of this soil will be turned over by those micrometeorite impacts. Gardened is the expression sometimes used. And that's probably enough to pretty well dissipate those footprints. What it will do to the lunar rover in that time was probably just erode the metal and other things on it. You'll still know a lunar rover's there, but it may be in pretty bad shape after 1 million years. One of the more important discoveries, which I'm not going to spend much time on, was the orange soil. It was the only soil that only material we found on the moon that was distinctly more colorful than anyone had expected. And this print is not a good print. I admit that. I've tried to get good prints, and maybe when we get these original films digitized, we will finally be able to show exactly how orange the soil was. But if you look at that object in the left middle ground, which we called a gnomon, it was useful in calibrating our photography, there is a orangish color wedge there. Well, that's an international orange color, and obviously it hasn't been printed to that color, even given the fact there's a little dust on it. And if it had been printed to that color, the orange soil itself would have been much more orange in this picture. So we just live with this until we finally somehow get a decent print. This is what it looked like in thin section. So you can see it's quite orange. These little beads reflected light like a beaded reflector does along the highways. And really it was quite spectacular to see once I had dug into it at this particular site. Those the dimension across that field of view in this photomicrograph is about 2.5 millimeters. So you can see those beads are extremely small. They average about 40 microns in average diameter. The soil of the moon is really quite stable. It has a very high bearing strength. However, the more you work on it and move around, the more it's going to get stirred up, as you see here. Remember, there's no atmosphere on the moon, so the dust that you stir up just sort of flops over on the surface once again and doesn't billow around you to cause any problems that way. But it does gradually penetrate anything that isn't sealed. And indeed, some of our tools just stopped working, the ones that we had to connect and disconnect, just because of the abrasive nature of this dust. It is in that dust that we find the resources of the moon that may very probably take us back there. I am working, as was indicated in the introduction, with a team of people, mostly from the University of Wisconsin, to try to move forward our ability to use the energy resources of the moon, particularly a light isotope of helium called helium-3. That is an ideal fuel from an environmental and efficiency point of view for fusion power and electrical power production. We are working very hard at that, and then you're looking right at the type of material that is our resource once we're able to get back there. The last picture I took out the right-hand window looking to the west is here, showing not only a science station in the middle ground, those little spots and specks out there are an actual operating science station, but also some tracks of the rover and yours truly as I went back and forth trying to get some of the experiments to work better than they did when we first deployed them. But eventually, after 72 hours on the moon, we had to leave, and leave we did with this not very good photograph of our departure taken off a television screen in the Mission Control Center in Houston. The rover had been parked about 300 meters away from our launch area so that it could take these pictures being operated remotely from the Earth by one of the flight controllers. Gene Cernan tried to persuade me to go outside and get a really good picture of liftoff. But as you can see, I declined the offer. We very quickly, within about a half, I think it was about 45 minutes, we had joined up in orbit with Ron Evans and the Command Module America. He was kind enough to take this picture of our pumpkin-faced spacecraft, all that was left of it. And we returned the favor with this picture of the command and service module. The command module, which is the bright, shiny, cone-shaped object there, is all we brought back to Earth intact. It was our home throughout the time that we operated to and from the moon, and also for about 3 days in lunar orbit. And, of course, Ron Evans' home for all the 72 hours we were down on the surface. It served us extremely well, and if you ever happen to be in Houston, Texas, and want to visit with this spacecraft and just see how we, at least on Apollo 17, lived within it, it is on permanent display at a place called Space Center Houston, just outside the fence, as sometimes expressed, just outside the fence of the Johnson Space Center. Ron Evans was extremely addicted to two things, sleep, and he was the only astronaut I know that could sleep hard enough that you couldn't wake him up without an extreme amount of effort, and he also liked food. And we were very concerned that when we returned from our 3 days on the moon, that there wouldn't be food left. Well, there was some food left, but all the good stuff has disappeared. the good stuff being anything with any kind of flavor in it. Still, we survived and were able to get home some days later. Here, though, Ron is on his own, was demonstrating a problem that we had with our water supply. The water in the lunar module and the electricity were produced by what are known as fuel cells. Indeed, these are battery-like objects that take hydrogen and oxygen, combine them across a catalyst, and give you electricity and water. A very, very interesting technology. It's now being considered very seriously, at least in the United States, and I believe also Europe, and probably Japan, for inclusion in future automobiles. I think it'll be a while before they're very economic, but still it's a very, very important future technology for a wide variety of electrical power purposes. For us, though, we continued to have a problem. We brought it to the attention of the engineers repeatedly. They never were able to fix it, and this photograph is just to bring it to their attention one last time. The problem being that some hydrogen always ends up in your water. And here you see Ron has caused some of that most of that hydrogen to coalesce into one large bubble. Now, you may think, well, that's a minor thing to be worried about, but, minor things can be very irritating, particularly when you consume food, and with that food, a significant amount of hydrogen, and then that hydrogen has to come out. Your crewmates don't appreciate that. This demonstration also is being done using a particular food packet that, although generally the food was good and usable, this particular type of food was not. It's salmon salad. Salmon salad doesn't travel well. We brought it all home. We never ordered it. It always appeared in the menu. And next time you go to a space museum and you see food attributed to the astronauts, and there happens to be a bag of salmon salad, you know why there's a bag of salmon salad. It all came back. And if anyone in the audience is ever contemplating being an archaeologist, of having an archaeological career, just remember that. When you find around an archaeological dig material that you think they might have used, you always have to consider the possibility they just threw it away. Re-entry occurred at 35,000 miles an hour, in contrast to the 25,000 miles an hour that we left. The primary reason was, one, that the spacecraft systems and our operations could tolerate speeds of that kind, and two, it made sure that we were back on schedule and actually would splash down where the carrier had expected us to splash down when we left the Earth. The entry was quite exciting. We actually pulled 7 Gs initially during the entry, just very briefly, and then held about 4 Gs, four times gravity, during the several minutes while the computer flew to where it thought the carrier was. In fact, the computer knew very well where the carrier was supposed to be, and we never had any problem in that regard with navigation to that point. But the Navy became concerned when they saw how well we were doing, and began to move the carrier. They decided that they better park about 5 miles away in order to prevent a carrier landing, which would have made some of the Navy pilots quite happy, but would have been a very hard, survivable, but very hard landing for us. Once the main chutes came out at about 10,000 feet, we drifted down to a very relatively gentle splashdown in the Pacific Ocean near Samoa, one which unfortunately marked, in this case, the end of the Apollo program. The frogmen were in the water immediately from waiting helicopters, had a collar around the spacecraft to prevent it from accidentally being swamped by a wave. It hadn't happened, but we still took pains to make sure the samples did not end up at the bottom of the Pacific. And we eventually were lifted into the aircraft carrier, into the helicopter, and then flown over to the aircraft carrier Tycho for our final return. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the history of Apollo, I think, was a remarkable time. I think I can say that without fear that objectively written history in the future will contradict that. Certainly in the history of science, we gained for the first time a first-order understanding of another planet, namely the Moon, very much like our own, and one which has given us an insight, a very detailed insight, we probably couldn't have gotten any other way, into the early history of the solar system, and particularly the time when life was evolving here on Earth. That has given us a great deal to think about then, as well as continues to be the case now. In the history of technology, we symbolized by the astronaut there, we certainly did advance the technology base, the base of know-how for human civilization here on Earth. That base is still in use in many different ways. As somebody, as Newton has said, we, all of us in this room, from a technological point of view, stand on the shoulders of this technology, just to paraphrase Newton a little bit. The flag of the United States symbolizes not just what America did in response to John Kennedy's challenge, assisted by many people from all over the world, but also what free men and women can do, and particularly young men and women can do, when they are faced with a challenge that they believe should be met. I just should remind you again, drawing your attention to the Apollo 13 movie, that that movie would have led you to believe, looking at the age of the actors in the movie, that most of the people of Apollo, particularly those engineers and skilled workers that were in Mission Control Center and elsewhere doing all the hard work, were in their late 30s, early 40s. Well, actually, they were in their 20s. They're basically about the same age as graduate students here at this university. They were at their peak of their imagination, of their initiative, and, of course, of their motivation, believing that what they were doing was the most important thing they would do with their lives. And when you have that kind of motivation in nearly 450,000 young men and women, you can just about do anything that you put your mind to and that they are willing to consider and adopt as their own objective. Above the flag, the Earth symbolizes a new status that we have in the solar system. Sorry, the film has slipped there just a little bit. This is a picture of the Earthrise from behind the Moon, the one that we entered into that particular sweepstakes. We think it one of the best. But it does symbolize that human beings can now live on the Moon. They can live on Mars. The technology base is clearly capable of supporting that. Psychologically, we don't seem to have any problem thinking about those things. It's just a question of time of when it's actually going to happen. People sometimes regret that it's been 30 years since we went to the Moon and stopped going to the Moon, but in the long reach of history, that 30 years will probably not be noted very much. It's unfortunate for those of us who would have liked to continue to go, but in the long reach of history, I think we're going to take care of that. And so it's probably about time we took another walk on the Moon. Thank you very much.